You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The United States has a lot of work to do when it comes to children's rights. That's according to Human Rights Watch, an international nonprofit which reports every state, including California, is falling behind international standards when judged on four metrics: child marriage, child labor, juvenile incarceration, and corporal punishment. According to the scorecard, almost all states received a grade of D or F, including our state, which received a D overall. No states received a grade of A or B. To top it off, the United States as a whole is an outlier in adopting international standards to protect children when compared to nearly 200 other countries. We're going to take time today to better understand why and hear some solutions to improve the rights of children in California. I spoke with Elizabeth Calvin, Senior Advocate for Human Rights Watch Children's Division, and Dr. Elizabeth Barnert, a professor of pediatrics at UCLA and a juvenile justice policy advisor at the state legislature, as well as Congress. All right. Well, since we have two Elizabeths, I'm going to use last names too. So I'm going to start off with you, Elizabeth Calvin. Tell us more about your role with Human Rights Watch in the Children's Rights Division.
Yes, I'm based in California, and my focus is on youth justice, meaning how the state and how communities respond to children and young adults who are accused of crimes. And really, our goals in this work are focused on a system that is more healing, more health-focused, more based on research that shows what works when we address the needs of children who have committed crimes. So the three main areas that I work on are ending the transfer of children to the adult criminal court where they face adult penalties, ending the use of extremely long sentences, including the sentence of life with no possibility of parole for people under the age of 18, and being a part of transforming the youth justice system so that it is really health and healing focused for everyone involved, people who are accused of crimes and communities and those who have been the victims of crime.
And this was just one of four components that this scorecard looked at. And I got to tell you, when I looked at the scorecard, I was really shocked to see how much work the United States, and including California, which is considered one of the most progressive states in the country, has to go. And the four components that the scorecard was looking at was child marriage, corporal punishment, child labor, and juvenile justice. As you just said, what stands out to you about California? Because I think overall, and California is not alone in this, it was one of the majority of states that received a D or an F, and California received a D overall.
Yeah, I mean, I think this should be kind of a rude awakening for Californians and actually for Americans in general, because we did look at every single state and no state received an A, no state received a B. You know, some states received a C, others received D and F. And I just think what we found is that while many Americans and Californians in particular might think that we are upholding the rights of children, in fact, the opposite is true, particularly for the four areas that we chose. When I look at California, I think what we see is really, you know, a pretty abysmal record. We've definitely made progress in the area of youth justice, but there's definitely, you know, a long way to go. And when we look at corporal punishment, child labor, and child marriage, California is awful.
These standards that the scorecard basically judge states on in the United States were set by the United Nations. It's the Convention on the Rights of the Child. What I also found pretty shocking was that it was adopted by nearly 200 countries, I believe 196 over the last three decades. But the United States is the only country which hasn't ratified and adopted this international agreement on a federal level. They divert it to the states. Why is that?
Wow. Yeah, that's, you know, the Convention on the Rights of the Child is the most ratified international treaty ever. And the U.S. is the only U.N. member country that has not ratified it. You know, my understanding is one reason it was not ratified is the U.S. Did not want to agree that it would not sentence children to life in prison with no possibility of parole, that was one of the sticking points. You know, the way that U.S. law works, most of these issues, most of these laws are going to be things that happen at the state level and not the federal level. One exception to that is labor law. But most of these things are handled at the state level. And so that's why we see this kind of patchwork of laws, because there's just different jurisdictions, 50 different jurisdictions that are handling whether to live up to the Convention of the Rights of the Child or not.
Is that problematic to you that it's left to individual states as opposed to having federal policies in place when it comes to the rights of children?
Certainly. It just seems that there are a few things that are as important for a country to do than to protect its most vulnerable citizens. And young people, particularly young people who are facing the possibility of child marriage or corporal punishment or working in hazardous conditions or being put in prison, are particularly vulnerable. And yes, I think it would be very, very powerful if the federal government really took a stance on these issues and others that are in the Convention on the Rights of the Child. I think it would convey to states that they should be changing their laws. And in fact, the federal government has the power of persuasion also in terms of funding and other guidelines that they can use to have states treat their children better.
Especially on that topic of child marriage, your organization, Human Rights Watch, for the Scorecard, partnered with other nonprofits. On this arm, it was Unchained at Last, which is a nonprofit that's focused on ending forced and child marriage in the United States. Once again, I was surprised that nearly 300,000 children, according to this nonprofit, were married in America between 2000 and 2018, some of them as young as 10 years old, and that California is one of 8 states without a minimum age for marriage. I guess, what have been the consequences that you have seen in states failing to establish a minimum age of like 18 years old or not having a minimum age at all?
Well, I mean, I do want to put a finer point on it that a study by McGill University estimated that more than 23,000 children in California between those same dates of 2000 to 2018 were in child marriages, had been married as children. So that's a lot in California itself. And the research is pretty clear. Child marriage results in early pregnancy. It results in reduced educational achievement. It can result in mental health issues. And it certainly results in increased violence and also, in other words, people being victims of violence and also poverty.
Yeah, I mean, and also just thinking about child labor, the work in agriculture, I believe the minimum age to work in agriculture in California has a heavy agriculture workforce is 12 years old.
That's right.
I remember working on the border, the Texas-Mexico border, there are migrant students that, the districts understand that they're not there for an entire school year, that for a portion of the school year, they go with their families up to other states and they work in migrant labor. But according to the U.S. Department of Labor's most recent survey of California farm workers, 3% of farm laborers are between the ages of 14 and 19. So that seems like a relatively slim number. But your report also found that within that, there's an overrepresentation in worker injuries and fatalities when it comes to minors who are in this workforce. What should we understand about minors that are engaging and working in agriculture in California and the risks that come with it?
Well, actually, it was a U.S. government study in 2018 that found that children in agriculture account for half of work-related deaths, even though they are, as you mentioned, only 3% of child workers. So that's a pretty shocking and terrible result. And the reason is because in a place like California, the minimum age is 12. And when we say the minimum age is 12, they can work full time at age 12. And the minimum age in California for hazardous work is 16. Now, the international standard on that is that no child under age 15 should be working in fields, and no child, period. No one under age 18 should be doing hazardous work. So examples of hazardous works are, you know, using equipment that is heavy equipment or potentially dangerous equipment. In the South, where tobacco is grown, there are hazards that come from touching the wet leaves, and it transfers nicotine. And we've found in studies, Human Rights Watch has found in studies there, that children oftentimes have nicotine poisoning and are throwing up and dizzy and have headaches. And we don't know about long-term effects. I mean, I think these are things that are understood internationally, that the standard should be 15 in order to work in any job, and no hazardous work under age 18.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're speaking with Elizabeth Calvin with Human Rights Watch about how the United States, including California, is falling short on children's rights, according to its recent scorecard. So we're going to get to those other two components. Let's bring in Dr. Elizabeth Barnard at UCLA, a professor in pediatrics, as well as a juvenile justice policy advisor. You advise both the California State Legislature and U.S. Congress on juvenile justice policy. Your research has contributed to the passage of a handful of reforms here in California. Just starting from the beginning, when did your career in this begin?
I've been doing research in the field of youth justice since my residency training. I had a patient who was systems involved. I was taken care of on a regular basis at a federally qualified health center, and I wanted to understand him better and how to help him. And I did a research study with young people who were incarcerated. And I think the most important thing I learned, the study was on a meditation intervention for incarcerated youth. And I learned that they were young people who just wanted, you know, to do better and the best chance to succeed. I think in our society, we have a tendency to cast the kids aside, to think of the kids as failures, and most importantly, to forget that they are children, which is why this Human Rights Watch report is not surprising, and it's so helpful because it reminds us that these are kids. And so then in throughout my career, fellowship training and my research, I really focus on bringing in the public health angle, trying to understand the relationship between health and young people's justice involvement. So how can we better take care of the health of young people who are in the system? And how can we use a health lens to understand how to meet the needs of young people so they don't end up in the system at all?
I mean, you touched upon this part about society casting aside and even just forgetting the fact that these are children. What does the general public not think about, but should think about when it comes to juvenile justice?
Well, I think what we need to understand is that the youth justice system should really be used as a last resort. That's one of the fundamental principles in the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child, that children have the right to be healthy, to have the supports they need to develop and thrive. And so locking kids up is not an answer that's going to increase public safety, in addition to it being a violation of children's rights. So I think people need to understand when we think of children, we need to think of them as children. Think about how can we get them what they need in schools? How can we design mental health systems that meet their needs? How can we help everybody have the healthiest society?
Are there recurring ailments or health issues that you see in your research?
Absolutely. So the young people who are incarcerated face a lot of health inequities, and these health inequities overlap with the same risks that make it more likely for somebody to end up in the carceral system. So young people who are involved in the criminal legal system have much higher rates of mental illness, extremely high rates of exposure to prior trauma, very high sexual and reproductive health needs as well. So for example, 1 in 3 girls who are incarcerated, and this is from a nationally representative study in the United States, report ever having been pregnant. And 1 in 12 boys or girls who are incarcerated are teen parents. So what we're seeing is intergenerational transmission of risk with health disparities and cycles of carceral involvement.
In your viewpoint, where does policy fit in, given that you're a policy advisor to help curb and solve these systemic and, as you say, generational issues?
So there is a lot that can be done to transform our youth justice system and our response to young people. Elizabeth Calvin mentioned, for example, the Juvenile Life Without Parole, which thanks to her work through Human Rights Watch, we've now ended in California. Another important example is the minimum age of juvenile court prosecutions. So that was one of the elements looked at in the Human Rights Watch report. So California right now has a minimum age of 12, meaning that we recognize that children 11 and younger are too young to understand or benefit from being processed in the juvenile legal system. This falls short of the recommendations of the UN Convention of the Rights of the Child, which recommends a minimum age of at least 14. But it's an example where setting a hard policy line can really make a difference to protect kids. So I did research in this area in California with my research partner, Laura Abrams, and we requested data from the California Department of Justice because at the time, people really weren't talking about this issue. And to give you an example, in 2015, there were over 500 children less than 12 years old referred to probation in California. And the youngest child was 5 years old. That child was a Black boy who was referred for a curfew violation. And when we've looked at the data in California and across the country, what we see is that the racial disparities creep in at the youngest ages. So we know that the juvenile legal system is incredibly racially biased. The lifetime risk of imprisonment in the United States for a Black man is 1 in 3. That is a mind-boggling figure from the U.S. Bureau of Justice Statistics. And when you look at the youngest kids, there's an even greater disproportionality at the youngest ages with Black boys. Young Black children ending up in the juvenile legal system when we don't have these hardline policy laws. So Dr. Abrams and I interviewed people around the country about this question of children's involvement. And what we found is that every single point where someone is making a decision, where there's prosecutorial discretion or where a judge is making a decision, racial bias creeps in. And so it's very important to have policies that protect all children from involvement in the system. The recommendations, the principles in the United Nations Conventions on the Rights of the Child would take the United States and California very far along in terms of universally protecting children from the harms of the juvenile legal system.
When you talk to Congress members, when you talk to state lawmakers, what do you hear? I mean, when you're having conversations trying to get them collectively to adopt international standards, what do they tell you in response? Because, I mean, it hasn't happened at least at a federal level, and we're falling short in California.
So what I've learned is that there's a difference between policy and politics. So policy are the good ideas that I bring them as academics, the well-researched ideas, the passionate, well-thought-out ideas that advocates like Elizabeth Calvin and her colleagues bring them. And we see a lot of agreement, like, oh, this makes sense. And then their job is the politics. And that's when you hear terms like, this would be a heavy lift, or we don't want to, it's not strategic to use energy to try to get the United States to ratify the UN Convention of the Rights of the Child. And so there's a lot of political calculations that come into play. But what I found when working with lawmakers is that these issues involving children, and particularly these issues that Human Rights Watch chose to look at, they fundamentally resonate with people because we all believe in the value of protecting childhood. But politics sometimes gets in the way.
I want to move on to corporal punishment, because the Human Rights Watch believes corporal punishment should be prohibited at home. And that at home is really like the operative word for me, because I always typically thought of corporal punishment within like schools, you know, from like decades ago, like my mom would tell me about it. But some states have banned certain types of corporal punishment that could lead to serious injury or death. But broadly speaking, it's not prohibited really in any state at home. Some may view it as discipline. Others view it as child abuse disguised as discipline. From a juvenile justice perspective, what are some of the challenges of proposing and passing laws to ban corporal punishment at home?
So I think we have to keep in mind that we have a child welfare system that is also very racially biased and is overburdened. So this is not my area of expertise, but I think it's important that when we pass legislation, it's that we look to make sure that we're not creating unintended consequences. I believe that children should be protected from corporal punishment. I don't know the political calculations that have gone into California having its current stance, but This also kind of brings us back to a very important point about youth justice and about the Convention on the Rights of the Child, which is that none of these issues are in isolation. The UN Convention of the Rights of the Child, every single right is recognized as interdependent. And so all of these issues we see, we don't know the exact numbers. We're not tracking it well in California, but it seems like the majority of kids in the juvenile legal system have had involvement in the child welfare system. And most of them have some kind of trauma, whether it's physical, emotional, or neglect. And so, you know, I don't know the precise answer to these questions, but it is, I can see that these issues are very interrelated.
Well, Elizabeth Calvin, can you weigh in on this when it comes to corporal punishment in the home? And I guess when we get to corporal, that's kind of a formal term. Are we talking about like something like spanking or what are we talking about when we're talking about it within a home?
Well, the definition of corporal punishment, or one definition at least, is the use of physical force to cause pain and to use that in the context of punishing. And I've heard lots of different things raised in terms of, you know, don't tell me what to do with my kid, you know, kind of thing. Or, you know, people saying that it's a cultural thing to use physical force as a form of punishment.
And passed down from generation to generation as well. You know, like, Oh, well, that's what happened to me when I was a kid.
Right. And I think, you know, one of the things that we have in California that's a really big benefit is, like with Liz, Dr. Barnard here, and also Dr. Abrams, I mean, I think we have academics who are doing research and showing what works and what doesn't work. And there is really quite a bit of research showing that corporal punishment is ineffective, doesn't work to correct behavior. And in fact, it's harmful. And there's research that shows it's harmful to development. And there's an association between corporal punishment and mental health problems, aggression in childhood, aggression in adulthood, delinquent behavior, impaired cognitive activity of children. These should be enough for people to change their perspective on whether physical force that is intended to cause pain is the right way to correct behavior.
I want to ask both of you this. I'll start with you, Elizabeth Calvin. What gives you optimism in the future in California?
I think the thing that gives me the most optimism are my partners in this work, which are many, many community-based groups and individuals who have had personal experience, whether it's personal experience with child marriage or personal experience with getting the sentence of life with no possibility of parole, and just being, I guess, adjacent to them as they work on behalf of other people to keep these human rights violations from happening to others. It's just really inspiring, and it makes me feel like we are going to get there. The U.S. will eventually ratify the Convention on the Rights of the Child, and we'll get the states to a point where children are really valued and taken care of.
Dr. Barnard?
Oh, I love that response. So the children, I'm a pediatrician and researcher, and in my clinical work, I do spend time with young people who are involved in the juvenile legal system. These are kids who are going through a lot of tough stuff, and they are so strong, so kind, so respectful, and they give me a lot of hope. I think the progress that I've seen is also very exciting. 6 years ago, we weren't talking about the minimum age of young people's involvement in the juvenile court, and now we're talking about it on NPR. It's great. And I'm also part of a project looking at children's rights and for workarounds. How can we move forward to protect children's rights? And we've interviewed people in the United States and all around the world, and there's a lot that can be done. So that is very exciting, and there's a lot that's happening.
Finally, this is likely, I mean, for me, I was shocked multiple times, is going to be new for a lot of people to take in, and there's going to be a good amount of possibly marinating following listening to this. What do you want listeners to take away from this scorecard and this conversation? Dr. Barnard, I'll start with you.
We got a D. That's unacceptable. We deserved it. This report makes sense. I've read it very carefully. I've read the methodology. Nobody is happy with the D grade. We have to do better, and we can do better.
Elizabeth Calvin.
Yeah, just the same thing as if your kid came home with a D on a report card, I think, you know, you sit down and you figure out, how do we change this? What's the hard work that needs to happen? You know, where does the support need to happen? What needs to change? Because these are all goals that every single Californian should be behind. And if we work together on it, I think we can get there.
Thank you both for taking the time and sharing your work.
Thank you, Vicki.
Thank you.
That was my conversation with Elizabeth Calvin with Human Rights Watch's Children's Division and Dr. Elizabeth Barnert, a professor of pediatrics at UCLA and juvenile justice policy advisor. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.